A very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Nancy Durham. Ahead this hour, the latest on the politics of Kuwait, the small, oil-rich nation that's been quiet through the Arab Spring until now. With its parliament stormed yesterday by protesters, is autumn the season of change for the Gulf? And we'll head to Salt Lake City in Utah, where those waters aren't necessarily known to run deep with design talent. But the city's Design Week is looking to change perceptions.
It's actually our first ever, and Design Weeks are springing up, you know, all over the country, as well as places like Copenhagen and Beijing. And so we really wanted to be a part of that.
And this week, Canada unveiled its newest banknote, a $100 bill made entirely from plastic. We'll be talking to the Bank of Canada to see if Canadians are ready for change. All that right here in the next 60 minutes on Midori House. But first, let's get the latest news from around the world with Fiona MacDonald.
Monocle 24 News. Southeast Asian nations have endorsed Burma as the chairman of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, 2 years ahead of schedule. ASEAN formally gave Burma, or Myanmar, the chairmanship of the bloc in 2014, on hopes that the country can stick to reforms that could lead it out of half a century of isolation. The endorsement comes as US President Barack Obama, who's attending the ASEAN meeting in Bali, cautioned that Burma must continue to improve its human rights record. The Indonesian Foreign Minister, Marty Natalegawa, said it was important to continue with negotiations and dialogue.
It is not about the past, it's about the future. What the leaders are doing now by confirming Myanmar's designation as chair of ASEAN in 2014, we are trying to ensure that the process of change continues. The momentum is maintained.
Egypt's Islamist and liberal opposition have begun gathering in Cairo's Tahrir Square ahead of a mass rally tomorrow to protest against the military government's plans to change the constitution to shield the army from legislative scrutiny. Tahrir Square was the epicentre of an uprising that ousted President Hosni Mubarak from office in February. Political groups are demanding the military council announce a clear timetable for handing power to an elected civilian government, with a deadline for presidential elections no later than April 2012. An attack by army defectors on a major intelligence complex in a suburb in Damascus is said to have killed or wounded up to 20 police officers. It's prompted retaliation by Syrian security forces. Germany, Britain and France want the United Nations to condemn human rights violations in Syria. OPEC officials are considering estimates that demand for the group's crude oil in 2012 could average 1 million barrels per day less than their current output, suggesting it may start to look at trimming supply. The OPEC Board of Governors is meeting in Vienna this week in preparation for the gathering of its oil ministers in mid-December that will decide output policy. OPEC ministers failed to reach agreement at their last meeting 6 months ago as Iran successfully opposed a move led by top exporter Saudi Arabia to raise OPEC quotas to meet a shortfall in supplies from Libya. Italy's new Prime Minister Mario Monti has said that his country is facing a serious emergency as he promised rigour and fairness in painful reforms to dig the country out of a financial crisis that threatens the entire eurozone. He said this comes on a day when thousands protested in Rome against unemployment and welfare. He added that Italy risked having its fate decided by other countries if it did not act. And Denmark's new Prime Minister said today that the European Union should address the financial crisis before looking at treaty changes. In a joint interview with German Chancellor Angela Merkel, Helle Thorning-Schmidt said she understood Berlin's interest in pushing through EU treaty changes to impose fiscal discipline on the eurozone, but believed the first priority should be resolving the immediate debt crisis. She said an EU summit in December would dismiss treaty changes, but she believed these should have a narrow focus.
I think it is very, very important that we focus on solving the discipline crisis and having a sound economies in Europe. And this will be our view. First solve the crisis, and then we can discuss how to create more discipline at a later stage.
Britain has agreed to sell nationalised lender Northern Rock to Virgin Money, the banking arm of Richard Branson's Virgin Empire, in a loss-making deal that marks the start of the government's exit from banks it bailed out in the 2008 crisis. It's expected to fetch between £747 million and £1 billion. That represents a loss of at least £400 million in equity pumped into the lender by taxpayers. Those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Well done, Fiona MacDonald, with the news. Thank you. Very nice to meet you here in the Monocle 24
and you,
studio.
And you. Nice to meet you too.
And we'll see you again in just about 25 minutes' time, I think.
Let's hope so.
Thank you, Fiona. Thank you very much. And now it's time to go all around the world to see what the global weather is going to be all about with Tomasz Szafranaker.
The weather, in association with Kiwoni Travel.
The near-record mild and persistent weather is set to last across Western Europe into next week. Scandinavia is also experiencing one of the mildest Novembers since 1900. However, colder, with night frosts over Germany, Poland, Hungary and further east. And there's no change to this weather pattern for now. It's Friday's city forecast. London, 14 degrees, partly cloudy. In Madrid, 13 with rain showers. In Munich, 8 Celsius, mostly sunny here. In Stockholm, 4 degrees and cloudy. North America, and it's been wet and stormy along the eastern seaboard of the United States, even tornadoes in some southern states. A vast improvement in the weather over the next couple of days. Sunny, but colder. It's Friday's city forecast. Philadelphia, 6 degrees and sunny. In Chicago, 2 degrees, sunny. Toronto, 4 Celsius, cloudy. In San Diego, 20 degrees, partly cloudy. And on air travel, if you're travelling from JFK or Dulles, the last of the storms and wet weather should clear Thursday night local time. Let's head to Asia Pacific, and rainstorms are developing across eastern China. The rain will head to South Korea and engulf much of Japan over the weekend. There could be some problems and delays at airports like Osaka and Tokyo. Here's Friday's city forecast. Shanghai, 22 degrees, rain showers. In Seoul, 17 with rain showers. Osaka and Tokyo, 18 Celsius, and rain turning very heavy. That's all from me. I'm meteorologist Tomasz Szafranaker here on Monocle 24.
And thank you, Tomasz Szafranaker. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. The time's approaching 7 minutes past the hour. In a moment, we'll be talking with Dr. May Imani, leading writer and commentator on Middle Eastern affairs, to hear about the recent protests in Kuwait.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And Monocle 24 Tagat, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 is your cousin.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, it is quiet today in Kuwait, as far as we know, quiet after yesterday's storming of the parliament. This tiny, oil-rich Gulf state has one of the few democratically elected governments in the region, yet many people are not happy. Yesterday, protesters called for the downfall of the prime minister, blaming him for alleged wide-scale corruption in the regime. Could a Gulf spring be in the offing? Well, Dr. May Imani, commentator and writer on Middle East affairs, is with us now in the Monocle 24 studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
The people rose up yesterday and rushed the parliament. Why did they do that?
We know that the Arab Spring is not over, and there is no country in the Middle East or no Arab country that is spared from the demands of their people for citizenship rights, for end of repression, end of corruption. So what we saw yesterday really is interesting, because as one of the rich Gulf Arab monarchies, or that Kuwait has the most modern system of government, and they have parliament, and they have vote, and they have, but what the people were asking for is end of corruption, and specifically against the prime minister. But they also want that the prime minister, they were saying, we want the model from Morocco. Don't compare us with the Gulf Arab countries. We want that the executive power of the prime minister is amongst the people, from somebody who's technically competent. We do not want another al-Sabah ruler. So that should end, and this is really what they were asking for.
They want people to crack asking, the dynasty, the family.
They want to make sure that the dynasty can continue, the rights of the ruling family can continue. They didn't go so far as others in Bahrain have done. But they were asking for the usual Arab Spring questions, that is, citizenship, dignity, political transparency, and more freedom of expression.
What is the most critical issue for them? I mean, you list those typical, you know, the list that we're now hearing about country after country, but is there a key problem that you could put your finger on for the people of Kuwait?
The problem that is from the usual elites and the ruling families there is that they are using the old methods, as in corruption or using money. I mean, Kuwait sits on 10% of the world oil reserves and revenues of the world. Using money, using fragmentation and fracturing the society. What is very interesting is we have seen how many times the prime minister has reshuffled the cabinet ministers and the parliaments, and using new money to pay different members of different tribes, and even sectarian, even the Shia groups. And the old methods are not working in Kuwait, and they are not working elsewhere.
And the money, the power is concentrated at this layer at the top. That's what
it's
you're talking about.
The layer at the top, but it is paid. Paying off people is a very short-term solution, and it's an old method.
Paying of people, exactly?
For example, if you go next door to Saudi Arabia, the large dominant country in this Gulf Cooperation Council, when the Arab Spring and after the outset of Zain al-Abidin bin Ali and then Mubarak and then the problems in Libya and elsewhere, what happened is the king came back and promised people that £37 billion and as well as, of course, using religious dogma and other means. What I mean by, if you are a sugar daddy, if you give the people money, then you can buy their subservience and submission. But this is not working, especially in countries like Kuwait.
Is it stopped working because they're seeing what's going on in the neighborhood?
Absolutely. In this case, you have the technologies of globalization, ranging from Al Jazeera to, of course, the Facebook and Twitter, and what people are, they're connected to their peers in the region. Today, I was very interested to hear that Kuwaitis and members of parliament are comparing themselves to Morocco and not to the region. So there are all the different, the old criteria of dividing the region on basis of oil versus non-oil, or all the criteria are changing. And the rulers need to wake up and use new methods of relating to their people, the ruled and the rulers.
Well, let's talk about the rulers waking up in Kuwait or not. We saw the storming of the parliament yesterday, quickly put down. Today there are reports from Reuters of the forensic teams inside the parliament looking for fingerprints of the demonstrators and promising, you know, that every measure will be taken to prevent any future unrest. What does this tell us about the message the Kuwaiti leadership has, or whether it is awake or not?
Denial remains the main state of mind of Kuwaiti ruling family and other ruling families in the region, and different ways of concealment and denial. So we have seen excuses everywhere. What they do not want is to face, to understand first, what are their people demanding? What are the new generation of Kuwaitis or elsewhere, what are they really demanding? And this is a very difficult problem. It's a point, we are now at a point of no return in the Arab world in general, and especially now among the oil-rich countries. Despite the fact that external factors, and let's not forget the stance of the United States and others, and how selective they have been in supporting their allies.
Okay, Dr. May Imani, I want to thank you. We're not going to leave you. We're going to have a short break. We want to stay in the region. Monocle Middle East contributor James Longman is going to join the conversation with us after a song from the Algerian artist Cheb Mami. Well, Dr. May Imani, commentator and writer on Middle Eastern affairs, is still with us. We've been listening to her the last few minutes. And now we're joined by Monocle 24 Middle East contributor James Longman. And James, just before we went to that Algerian piece of music, Dr. Imani was talking about the Americans and selectivity in the region. Do you want to pick up there with me?
I think that's absolutely true. I'd be interested, though, before we touch on the Americans, talk on other foreign groups, namely the Arab League. You mentioned Bahrain. Now, Bahrain, a really repressive crackdown on its own opposition movement, another group which the Kuwaitis perhaps could learn a lesson or two, may perhaps not make the same mistakes as the Bahrainis have done, because obviously the opposition there called for the ousting of the Prime Minister, and then it escalated from there on in. But the opposition in Bahrain, their recent request to the Arab League to recognise the opposition wasn't agreed to, wasn't heard by the Arab League, yet the Arab League were very happy to listen to what they had to say about Assad. So I'd like...
In Syria.
Really, in Syria, yeah. So I'd like, you know, a couple of points perhaps, May, on how you feel the Arab League's role could develop here with regard to the Gulf. What will it take for the Arab League really to listen to the people it's supposed to represent?
The Arab League have been viewed, and if you look at all the websites in the region, as very influenced by the American, the United States direction. So, of course, Bahrain remains among the allies, and even the others, whether they were... I mean, by the time we reach Bahrain... they had to take a stance of protecting the ruling family there. I think you see the contrast between Yemen and Bahrain. Up to now, look at the Yemenis, and they still negotiating with Ali Abdullah Saleh. And he's doing very similar crimes against his people as al-Assad is doing in parts of Syria. But there is a selective, hypocritical policy.
So by that token, then, you'd say that these springs, if that's what they may become, will need foreign intervention, foreign help.
I'm saying that the springs are witnessing at the moment foreign influence, be it soft power, Al Jazeera, and other channels, or just rhetoric, you know, statements from the White House. And, of course, we saw in Libya a successful military intervention. So there is a military theater going on, there is hard power going on, but only in Libya until now. There is foreign intervention. What really most of the people are saying, and they were saying that this is our revolution, this is our democracy. We are the citizens. We are Egypt. We are Yemen. And we need to deal with it on our own. We don't want others to either resuscitate Ali Abdullah Saleh, as in the United States, or intervening and supporting the Al-Khalifa in Bahrain.
But how much of a stretch do you think it would be for the Arab League to really start to put weight on the Gulf? You know, 2 years ago, for us to think that anyone at the Arab League was going to start criticising Assad would be out of the question. Yet it happened. And I'd have a word on perhaps on Saudi's influence. Would, I mean, this is the great, if you like, the huge monarchy built on oil. How is there a chance that this Gulf Spring could take effect and really kind of move in as a contagion into the rest of the peninsula?
The first part of your question regarding the Arab League, until now we have seen that they have been working in harmony with the United States and with the allies. You remember the old division that we used to see, the moderates from the days of Bush, the moderates versus the radicals. So Syria falls into the radicals and anti-US and close to Iran. And that is where they're still, the Arab League had it easier for the Arabs to criticize strongly Assad and not the others. To come to Saudi Arabia, I would say no kingdom is an island. And no country in the region is spared from the wrath of its people. People have united, people are organized, and the Saudi young men and women are not different from others.
I'm getting the signal to wrap on this. We are running out of time, but just very quickly, could you make a comment on the Americans? Are they going to come to the rescue in some way, in some sort of soft power support or what have you, to the Kuwait? They have a lot of business in Kuwait.
Yes, the Americans will continue to guard and protect their interests and strategic interests in the Gulf region, and that is in the light of their fear of the hegemony of Iran, and also, of course, protecting their long-term allies, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, Oman, Bahrain, and they will continue to do that, but things will change and there have been more surprises.
Just that we haven't even touched the top of the iceberg. May Imani, thank you very
much.
Thank
you very much.
James Longland for joining us. Thank you very much.
In the new issue of Monocle, we ranked the world's soft superpowers.
The UK and France were the first joint winners of our soft power survey last year. This time around, who won? Well, you'll just have to see. But we had more countries, we had more metrics, and we had a few extra special surprises.
We survey the state of Denmark in a 36-page supplement.
For the Monocle Denmark survey, we went beyond Copenhagen, looked beyond bicycles, the Tivoli Gardens and island living, to meet the people, places and businesses who really drive modern Denmark.
In the design section, we took a trip around London to see how all the Olympic commissions are using London's homegrown talent. And we also went to an island haven in the Swedish archipelago and did a bit of skinny dipping.
And we also have our picks of the 100 people, places and products you need to meet, see and sample in 2012. All that, plus our travel top 50, our holiday gift guide and a trip to the borderlands of China and Russia in the December-January issue of Monocle. On newsstands now or via subscription at monocle.com.
And do not miss that copy of the magazine. Well, with more than 70 design festivals each year all around the world, every city or town wants in on the action, it seems. Well, one of the latest to join the circuit is Salt Lake City, whose design week has been underway since Monday. Not exactly a destination of global renown, perhaps, for the design industry, but our design editor Hugo McDonald took time out earlier with co-chairman of the event, Kevin Perry, to hear what it's all about.
Yeah, it's actually our first ever, and so, you know, we've been seeing that design weeks are springing up, you know, all over the country, as well as, you know, places like Copenhagen and Beijing, and so we keep seeing more and more happen all the time, and we really wanted to be a part of that. We have, you know, a good design community here that tends to be, you know, fairly secluded and not known about as much, and so we really wanted to get it out into the public. So
this is a design week that is for the local community, or is there quite a lot of international representation there as well? Have you got a lot of tourists who are coming to discover the city for the first time?
You know, it's pretty local, our first year. Definitely not international. We did have some national speakers. We had a gentleman, an architect from New York last night. We had someone from Minnesota a couple nights ago as well. And so we do have a diverse group of speakers, but pretty much the audience is our local design community here.
And so the idea is that it's bringing this community together then as a showcase of what Utah has to offer and how different people can help each other. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely. We have a lot of design organizations like AIGA, SEGD, AIA, so architects, environmental designers, and graphic designers. And we really want to break those barriers between these organizations so they can collaborate more, so the public is aware of what's available in this community. People that just are design enthusiasts that maybe aren't involved in these organizations can get involved and appreciate design and our local creative community.
Sounds fantastic. A lot of acronyms there. I'm not entirely sure what they all stand for, but I'll take your word for it. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what the week is consisting of. You mentioned some talks previously, but are there some exhibitions and things on there as well?
We have a new natural history museum that is just opening tomorrow, and it's a fantastic building, one of the best pieces of architecture in our state, and if not the country. It's supposed to rival the Natural History Museum in New York. It's such an impressive building. And so tomorrow night we have a panel of the national architects, the local architects, the exhibit designers, the environmental designers, the brand specialists that worked on this building, all sitting on a panel talking about their experience in creating this museum.
That sounds fantastic. And who are the architects behind the museum?
So there's Pullen and Morris. There's Ralph Applebaum, I think, were the exhibit designers, Applebaum and Associates. And so a lot of, great names out there in the community, both in New York and our local community here as well.
Fantastic.
Infinite Scale Design Group did the new brand and logo, and they'll be on the panel as well.
Brilliant. And I like the idea that there's a strong sort of education theme running through the week, that it's about of teaching the public that design is good for a force for change on a very sort of local scale, and also in terms of how it can contribute to the city on a wider scale too. Have the public responded well?
Yeah, definitely. We were kind of amazed at how involved the public has become and how much bigger this event this week turned out, from what we initially expected. We, hoped for our first initial year that it would get some attention, and we were, happy with whatever we could get, but every event has been sold out throughout the week. We're seeing people that typically don't attend design events like this that are coming. We have, business leaders and marketing specialists and people, outside of the immediate design community that are taking part in all of these events. And so it's just been, very impressive to see the people that are getting involved for the first year.
Well, that sounds like a huge success, and it seems like many design weeks around the world that have been doing it for years and years could definitely take a leaf out of your notebook. So going forward, is this something that might become an annual event then, do you think?
Yeah, we definitely hope so. And so I know I mentioned AIGA, an acronym that maybe you weren't familiar with.
No.
AIGA is the Professional Association for Design, and it's over 22,000 members in the country, and chapters across the U.S. as well. And so we have a Salt Lake City chapter here. And AIJ is actually involved nationally. There's offices in China. And so they've kind of been the leader in creating design weeks. And we've seen more and more year after year that keep happening. San Francisco is on their fifth year, I think, of their design week. D.C. just had their third design week. And so I hope that we can continue to do this with AIGA's help and look to, creating an annual event. And then hopefully, it seems like in the future, I can see, a national design week where they're happening in cities all across the country during that same week, similar to Fashion Week, is in the U.S. as well.
Of course. I mean, do you feel like there might be a danger with this sort of rapid growth of design weeks all over the states and actually all over the world, that they sort of become diluted in significance?
I don't think so, because the unique thing about this type of event is the bigger it is, the better. I've been involved with design events in the past, and you always hope that, you get one event and you get a good turnout and you don't want things competing with it. We have the kind of the opposite feeling with Design Week. We hope that they're events happening simultaneously, you know, all across the city, and people can pick and choose. And so the bigger, the better. And we hope that, you know, it will grow. And I don't think it will get diluted because there's such a diverse amount of design disciplines. I think you can have, you know, product design events going on while there's print design or interactive design or, you know, architecture. And so I really think, you know, there's a lot of room for growth.
The more the merrier, it sounds like. Well, congratulations on the first event, Kevin, and I hope Salt Lake Design Week happens next year because I'll definitely be booking my flight.
Okay, and that was Kevin Perry of Salt Lake City Design Week talking with our very own Hugo MacDonald. And now it's time to get some news headlines with our very own Fiona MacDonald.
Thank you. Southeast Asian nations have endorsed Burma for the chairmanship of its regional grouping in 2014, gambling that the isolated country can stick to reforms begun this year that could lead it out of half a century of isolation. Greek police have clashed with anti-austerity protesters, and Italy has announced sweeping reforms in response to a European debt crisis that today pushed borrowing costs for France and Spain sharply higher. And Italy's new Prime Minister, Mario Monti, says his country is facing a serious emergency as he promised rigour and fairness in painful reforms to dig the country out of its financial crisis that threatens the entire eurozone. Voter anger over Spain's economic plight is certain to sweep the centre-right People's Party to an election victory on Sunday, giving it resounding mandate to slash public spending and try to rescue the country from its eurozone crisis. Opponents of ousted Thai Premier Thaksin Shinawatra have said that they could take to the streets if the government, led by his sister, tries to push through an amnesty that would let him return from exile a free man. Kuwait's emir has ordered security forces to take all measures to maintain public order after protesters stormed Parliament demanding the resignation of the Prime Minister over alleged corruption. And hundreds of Occupy Wall Street protesters marched through New York's financial district towards the stock exchange today to protest against economic inequality at the heart of American capitalism. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle News 24.
You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 in London with me, Nancy Durham. Now, you may think that everywhere takes plastic these days. Digital money is the way to go for young businesses and entrepreneurs. But the humble banknote is fighting back with new technology and a new lick of paint in Canada with the launch this week of a new $100 note made from plastic polymer. It follows nations like Australia who have ditched paper for something more durable and current. Well, we have Julie Gerard, currency spokesperson of the Bank of Canada, on the line now. Hello, Julie.
Hello.
What a nice job to have the job of talking about money.
It's very exciting.
Let's put this $100 note on the radio, please. Could you take us there? Describe it for us.
Well, it's very different from what Canadians have seen in the past. It is, the main difference is basically that it is now made of polymer, as you indicated earlier. It is one smooth piece of polymer, and when you look at it, the most striking feature is that you can actually see right through it. There is a large transparent area. If you're looking at the front of the note, to the right side, there is a top to bottom large transparent area, and within that transparent area, there are two metallic elements. The photo of Borden, a prime minister in the from 1911 to 21, and at the bottom there is actually a parliament building.
And this see-through bit, is that the sort of high-tech, really security part of this note? Tell us why you've got a see-through note.
Well, because you're absolutely right. That is for security reasons, and that's why we put this note out. We wanted to step up security. We wanted to take advantage of advances in technology and produce the most secure note that we've ever put out here in Canada, but also among the most secure notes in the world. And this transparent area is very difficult to counterfeit, and the transparent, the metallic elements within the transparency also makes it very difficult to counterfeit. And if you turn the note over, those metallic elements are reproduced or identical on the flip side of the note, if you will.
Okay, now, and can you fold it up? I mean, I use a change purse and I fold up my notes, my very few notes, and put them in there. Can you do that with a plastic note?
You can. So these new notes actually handle pretty much the same as the paper notes. We, of course, at the Bank of Canada, encourage people to take care of their notes and make sure that they are put in a wallet flat, and you know, we want to preserve the life of the note. But these new notes, actually, if you fold them and if you lay them flat on a table, they will bounce back. They will go back to their original shape.
I mean, you fold them and then they go flat again?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. It might take a couple of hours or even a couple of days. If you really, really crease them, that is actually going to damage it, and it's going to maintain the crease. So that's what I was mentioning, that we don't recommend doing that. But if you just put it in your wallet, that's not going to be a problem.
Okay, Canada, you're catching up with Australia and some other nations. Britain doesn't have, as far as I know, any sign of going in this direction. Is there a trend, or can I ask why isn't everybody doing this if it's so good?
Well, I can only speak to Canada's new notes, and the reason why we decided to go to polymer is because the level of security that we can now put in a polymer note was at the level that we felt was appropriate for us. It was basically the best option for Canada. In 2004, in Canada, we actually had a spike in counterfeiting that was the highest we've ever seen as a nation, and it was up to 470 parts per million. And essentially what that means is for every million genuine notes, there were 470 that were fakes or counterfeits. Now, we've worked very hard, and we've lowered that to about 35 parts per million. But what we want to do is we wanted to create a banknote that would not only maintain that trend, but would actually lower it. And we felt that polymer was really the best option, and the level of security that polymer permitted us to include in the note was what we were looking for.
Can't let you get away without asking you about that Prime Minister, Robert Borden. Now, he may not have leapt to people's minds immediately if you were, you know, looking around for a Canadian PM to put on the note. Why him?
Well, actually, he's been on our banknote for a long time, on the 100 for a long time. And, you know, I've been...
That just shows you, how few encounters I've had with $100 banknotes.
Well, what we wanted to do with this new note is basically put all the security that I just mentioned. So it is a very different looking note and a different feel to the note. So what we wanted to do is of course we wanted to maintain the portraits there because they do have a significant significance in Canadian history, but also we wanted to make sure that there was some consistency because, you know, in Canada the $100 note is brown and the new note is brown again, and former Prime Minister Borden is still on the 100. So we wanted to maintain those elements as well so that there was a consistency.
Julie Girard, Bank of Canada, thank you very, very much.
My pleasure.
Bye for now. Let's have a song. We have the Pet Shop Boys with Opportunities. Let's make lots of money. And you are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. I'm Nancy Durham.
Every week, Monocle editor Andrew Tuck looks at cities around the world and the people, buildings and open spaces that make up the urban landscape. With interviews and discussions of the spaces and places we live in, The Urbanist is your very own urban audio retreat. That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24, and also available on our timeshift player at monocle.com and, of course, on iTunes.
Every month, Monocle deploys over 70 writers and photographers to over 50 countries to deliver our print edition. Covering a unique mix of global affairs, business, culture and design, Monocle publishes 10 magazine editions a year and 2 special newspapers during the summer and winter holiday seasons. With a subscription to Monocle, you'll not only be the first to receive the magazine, you'll also be invited to special events and receive our iconic tote bag from Rutote of Japan. Subscribe to Monocle from £80 sterling at our website at shop.monocle.com/subscriptions. Subscribe to Monocle and keep an eye on the world.
Just after Midori House, we'll be premiering the 5th episode of The Urbanist at 1900 London time. This week, editor Andrew Tuck traverses the globe in search of the best places to take a seat and watch the city go by. Here's a clip from the show, taking us from Auckland to Paris via London and Madrid, checking out some of our favorite park benches.
We're down at a little bay near our home, which is in Auckland, on the north shore of Auckland in New Zealand. When we come out of our home, we're surrounded by big bush reserves. And so when we've been for a kilometre or two through the bush, it's really good to sit here on this bench.
It's got a fabulous view through the native trees down to the bay, which at this time of the year has got lots of boats hauled out doing maintenance work on them, and they'll all go back as we're approaching summer. But of course, right in front of us, it is a pretty creek with bulrushes and the like in it, and then a sports ground. At the time we're normally here, which is early in the morning, it's really quite beautiful and peaceful.
It's a very accommodating bench. You said you described it as somewhat brutalist in its nature, didn't you?
And its architectural style, it is. Yeah. very Russian.
And having sat on many an uncomfortable bench in various parts of the world, we are very intrigued that such a simple bench can provide such lovely comfort.
So we're sitting right next to Waterloo Bridge. The bench is kind of nice wooden, brown wooden bench. It has a sign on it that says, "Everybody needs a place to think." And I think that's right. Especially by the river here. It's quite a beautiful day today, sort of autumn, nice autumn sunshine. And yeah, just kind of watching the city go by. As ever, the bridge is very full of traffic, but it's nice and quiet and calm down here, and just, yeah, I think the sign has it all. You know, everybody needs a place to think, so I think this is the place. I work around here, so just on lunch break, so kind of nice to come and get away from work and just kind of just watch there's a ferry going by under the bridge, and it's just nice. It's a nice area.
We are in Paris in Les Buttes Chaumont. It's a really big, beautiful park in the 19th district. And I really like this place because it's green, there is a lot of space, the view is really wonderful at the top of the park because you can see a lot of Paris. It's really nice to walk around in this park, and in summer we come here very often to have picnic. The view from the big mountain in the middle of the park is really beautiful. You can see a lot of northwest Paris, and you have a beautiful view on Montmartre. Since I live in Paris, I always lived around the park. And so I always knew this park to look around and have rest.
I'm from Madrid, Spain, sitting on a bench here in Retiro Park, which means retreat in English. What I can see from here is quite a weird picture because I am just in front of the Fallen Angel statue, which is a 5-meter statue with a fallen angel on the top and several demons spilling water on the bottom. Well, it's surrounded by people skating and sitting on a bar, having some tapas. Just seeing the statue of the devil is quite a bizarre image, actually. At the back of me, these people doing gymnastics, people boxing on the left, lots of people walking the dogs, and full of tourists taking pictures of the devil statue. This is the perfect spot, the perfect place to escape from the chaos of the city centre, just basically relax from the chaos of the city.
That's The Urbanist, coming up later on Monocle 24. And now we have a song for you, Little Dragon with Looking Glass. And now it is monologue time, so let's go to Monocle editor Andrew Tuck to hear a short reflection on acronyms. From AWOLs to zip codes, why do some stick and join the popular language? But why do some disappear from the mouth and mainstream culture forever? Well, Andrew Tuck has this to say.
Jim O'Neill was giving a talk this week at the British think tank Chatham House. It was about 10 years of BRIC. O'Neill has gained a certain fame because of that acronym. He invented it in his role as a Goldman Sachs economist. Today there are BRIC institutes and conferences, all because he put those few letters in the right order. Those countries never thought of formally aligning themselves until he came along. They were inspired by an acronym. Now they have spoilt it all by admitting South Africa. BRICSA is not so good. Others have tried to outdo O'Neill. So we now have the CIVETs. That's Colombia, Indonesia, Vietnam, Egypt, Turkey, and South Africa. Do the South Africans join every club going? I like CIVETs. You imagine a lean nation coming out of the undergrowth, ready to pounce on some worn-out, flabby, old-school economy. But pigs, on the other hand, seems a little harsh. Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece and Spain may be the bad smell at the Euro party, and their leaders may have had certain trough-feeding tendencies, but even so. And the double I in pigs, one for Ireland and one for Italy, is not elegant. A good acronym can lodge itself so successfully in your vocabulary that you forget it even is one. SCUBA, LASER and RADAR are all acronyms, or you may struggle to recall what they actually stand for. I'll help you. SCUBA stands for Self-Contained Underwater Breathing Apparatus, LASER for Light Amplification by Stimulated Emission of Radiation, and RADAR for Radio Detection and Ranging. Yikes, you can see why they came in handy. Linguists also love an acronym, aka initialism, and they have marshalled them into all sorts of categories, from recursive to pseudo and multi-layered. Of course, they can all go horribly wrong. Montreal Internationalized Software Testing is known by the oddly over-descriptive acronym MOIST. And the Moro Islamic Liberation Front really needed to think again before printing their badges. And every defence expert who launches into a discussion of man-portable air defence systems must wince when they have to say, man-pads. Of course, the culture of mobile phone texting and emails has spawned more acronyms than we can cope with. But at least it shows how alive our language is, even if many of these make you squirm when said out loud. LOL being a prime naphorism. But anyway, that's all I have to say on the subject. So, TTFN. For Monocle, I'm Andrew Tuck.
TY, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for that. And from there, we can only go to an acronym of a group, the ELO, and their song, Last Train to London. Well, that was ELO singing The Last Train to London. On the Monocle Daily tonight, that's at 2200 London time, we'll be looking at the United Nations Least Developed Countries Report that's just out today, and a professional explorer will be in the studio talking with Emma Nelson, who will be presenting. Well, we're coming to the moment when I need to say that's all from Midori House for today. It's time to thank our producer, Constance Cheng, our researchers, Tom Hall and James Longman, our studio manager, Anna Veal. Fiona MacDonald will soon have the news for us near the top of the clock, and of course, The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. And where would we be without Kylie and the Monocle Anthem? I love this tune.
LDN TYO NYC M24 LDN TYO NYC M24